FM.
The elite is out to control the world. The Russian, given the Russian mind and the technology we've given them, is going to use this technology back against us in forms which we don't accept. And there's no question that our establishment engineers haven't until recently accepted behavioral modification through radio engineering.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, Kevin Carhill, ex-Sunday Times journalist, and me, Tony Gosling. Coronavirus outbreak hits Hong Kong. How far is it going to reach? Is it natural or man-made? Are any of the three Labour leadership candidates up to the job? As Trump's misguided impeachment bombs by the Democrats, anyway, with John Bolton as their star witness that never was. Bernie Sanders being shut out again. Does that mean we've got a decade of Boris as well as another 5 years of Trump? Perfect lineup for the war machine. Bethnal Green's own ISIS girl, Shamima Begum, is in the news again today, denied her British passport. All just to cover up the fact that Canadian intelligence lured her out there on Facebook. Haven't heard that on the BBC, have we? Such an ominous thing for a member of the royal family to say when Prince Harry says, "If you knew what I know." And what does he mean? And what really happened with his mum? Did anybody bother to trawl through the British and French police reports into the so-called accident? And the inquest transcript? Well, yes, one man in Brisbane, Australia, did. His name's John Morgan, author of Princess Diana, The Paris-London Connection. And he found she'd been assassinated. Also, the Illuminati on trial in Thailand, a secret society set up to use revolutions and world wars to take over the world. I'll use left and right as just a childish illusion to distract our attention, or is all that just a conspiracy theory of a paranoid lunatic? That's just to show dialects here. On BCFM this Tuesday at noon this week, Nick Korkos from Avon Archaeology on the discoveries being made every week between demolition and before the foundations go in for our city's new buildings. I think Temple Island, maybe. Mostly student blocks right now, though, but Nick's your man. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download that show right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But we start with the coronavirus outbreak in Wuhan, in China, which has been running for a couple of weeks now. Actually, it started in December, Kevin, didn't it? And we hear the news that the first doctor that tried to raise the alarm about it, and who was shut down by the authorities in China at the time, has died of the virus himself. Anyway, what do you make of this?
The disease centre in Atlanta said right now that this is a SARS-related. The coronavirus is prevalent in lots of things, but they identified the origin of the SARS and this coronavirus with bats and camels. So, and the interesting thing is, in China, there's been huge outrage by ordinary people over what happened to the doctor. And the centralized system seems to have run for it, which is a very good thing. But yes, he was shut down by the police and told he was breaking the law or something. Now he's dead.
Martin, another piece of news, so-called news, when you were aware it's very difficult to tell what's true and what isn't this week, is that, well, it's nice to see that there's finally an acknowledgement of these two Well, I think one is a bio safety center in Wuhan, mm-hmm. and the other is the virology center in Wuhan. Both of them nationally important in China. So Wuhan is certainly a center for research around these sorts of viruses. But one of the things that we've heard this week is that there are some that believe that you can actually look at the DNA of this virus and see that it's been engineered rather than occurred naturally. Anyway, what do you make of the developments in the last week?
Well, obviously, I've been following it. You know, there's two possibilities. It's either a natural virus that has evolved naturally, or it's escaped in some way from a laboratory.
It could have been deliberately.
Yes, but when I say it's escaped from a laboratory, it could have been deliberately planted. Now, there's a very good article on Mint Press by Whitney Webb about this. And these laboratories in Wuhan have actually got contracts with US multinationals. Now, I can't remember all the detail off the top of my head.
Well, that's normal. That's what China does.
Right,
it trades.
That's right. That's right. But of course, if you were a US military intelligence operation, one of the things that would be very important for you at this moment is for China to have a coronavirus just on the Lunar New Year, just as they are trying to sign this trade deal, which isn't going to happen, just as you push up the stress and pressure in the South China Sea, just as you've been pushing people in Hong Kong to try and undermine the central government, and the same with the Uyghur issue. I'm not saying there aren't issues here, but there is definitely a desire to take China down. If you look at the internal discussions inside the US military establishment, they're definitely talking in terms of, we've got to take China now, because if we leave it much longer, they're going to be able to overcome us. So there's got to be suspicion, at the very least, of foul play here. And in that case, the Chinese government would scream from the rooftops, this is foul play. They wouldn't, because one of the interesting things about this is the time lag on the virus. It takes 10 to 14 days before people show symptoms. In other words, it looks like it's been, most flus, you start getting it at the same time as you're infected. Now, in other words, I'm not saying that there's one strand of the onion will be saying, well, it's escaped from these laboratories, the government's embarrassed about that, and that's why they've tried to keep it all quiet. A higher level than that would be, it is in fact biowarfare. And I've just sent you earlier today a report that came out about biowarfare by the US in Korea in the 1950s, and they basically dropped loads of biological weaponry all over North Korea. That's what they did. That's what they did back in the day. And if you think they've changed, or they're better people than they were then, you're deluded.
Well, were they dropping something to test weapons to see
been,
how
basically
fast...
Been using...
Martin, just let me finish the sentence. To test some sort of biological agent to see how quickly it spread? Or were these live, deadly illnesses they were spreading?
It was biological warfare to try and mess up their enemies. And that's what they did. And, of course, it's been uncovered by the really good Bulgarian journalists that they've got a biowarfare lab in Georgia. And they were going around all in Russia collecting DNA from Russian people. And eventually, the same thing happened in China, and they were kicked out by the authorities. Why are you doing that? They're trying to engineer viruses which are genetically focused so you can kill just black people. Just Chinese people.
But as I understood it, the Israelis were the centre for this, with world expertise on genetically targeted viruses.
Well, the guy who said that I've forgotten his name, the Israeli specialist on this, who said, oh, well, this is probably biowarfare by the Chinese, he was very involved in the whole idea of Saddam Hussein's WDM. Now, there's a lot of detail to people to get through there, but if they're interested, they should read Whitney Webb's article about it, and she shows the linkages between DARPA and other Pentagon-related organisations and these
laboratories. Can I just give you the name? It's Danny Shoham, former Israeli, S-H-O-H-A-M, former Israeli military intelligence officer who studied Chinese biowarfare. He said that the institute is linked to Beijing's covert biological weapons program, but he would say that, wouldn't he?
But he would. You see, what you do if you are a Western bio warrior, is you wait for your moment, like Chinese New Year, just as the negotiations about various things are coming to a head, and then you introduce it. Right, you introduce your virus right close to where these centers are.
But then you might also say, well, it's normal. People get flus in the winter.
Then that is perfectly logical and possible. All of these things are speculations. Right? It may be that this is just a virus which has mutated, and then we're going to have to deal with it, and it's nobody's fault, it's just stuff. That's perfectly logical, but it's not necessarily true. And if something else is true, then we've got to start thinking about who's doing what. And I would suggest to you that the people who are really pushing biological warfare and have been pushing it for years, and have been pretending to research it in order to prevent things happening, they are definitely the Western powers. The Russian biological and chemical warfare stuff was dismantled completely in the 1990s under agreements. It was all based in Uzbekistan, where Craig Murray was our ambassador, and he said, I went round, they dismantled a lot. They basically regard the West as rogue players, and they are right, because they are.
Well, the Western media have already staked out their claim to the fundamentals. This is some info that I got this week from a doctor. The actual origin has not been determined or stated by the authorities and is still an open question. Perhaps similarly, since viruses seldom jump species barrier without any human assistance. So this idea that it's going to go from a snake to a pig to a cow to a bat to a bird to a human, it doesn't normally do that. And so there's a degree of, well, we're just being told this has come from a bat, and maybe it hasn't. So, but anyway, almost immediately on receiving the actual genome sequence from the Chinese, Russian scientists suggested a link between the SARS virus and biowarfare. This is back in the previous outbreak. Sergei Koznikov, a member of the Russian Academy of Medical Sciences, said the propagation of the SARS virus might well have been caused by leaking a combat virus, they called, which is grown in bacteriological weapons labs, according to a number of news reports. Koznikov claimed that the virus of atypical pneumonia, SARS, was a synthesis of two viruses of measles and infectious parasititis, or mumps. So, there is some evidence, at least from the Russian scientists, saying, well, we believe that this could easily have been engineered.
Well, indeed, and of course we know that the Cubans, for example, we know from Freedom of Information requests that they were definitely dropping all sorts of stuff on Cuba. They've been working on this stuff for years. Meanwhile, pointing the finger, oh, the Russians are doing this, the Chinese are doing this, oh, they're terrible. And in actual fact, they've been doing it all along. And of course, what you do is it's such a slow-running virus that you don't, if you put something that killed everybody immediately, then it would be pretty obvious that it was a biological warfare attack. But if you can engineer the virus so that it creeps through any attempts to try and stop it, there's quite a long incubation period. And the other thing is then, of course, you gradually, basically, the stock market in China has started to wobble, and the idiotic idea in Washington and in London is that if we can crash the Russian and Chinese economies, that will teach them a lesson. Although, of course, we will follow them into the black hole.
Okay, so recent disease outbreaks, this is from this article. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Sharing stuff that seems pretty credible. This does. Recent disease outbreaks that would seem to possibly qualify as potential biowarfare agents are AIDS, SARS, MERS, bird flu, swine flu, hantavirus, Lyme disease, West Nile virus, Ebola, Syrian polio, foot and mouth disease, the Gulf War syndrome, and Zika. And in fact, thousands of prominent scientists, physicians, virologists, and epidemiologists on many continents have concurred that many of these viruses were lab-created and that their release was deliberate. Recent swine flu epidemic in China has the hallmarks. Sorry?
I was going to mention the swine flu. Swine flu, the Chinese pig herd has just died off from African swine flu fever. And it's 90%.
Hence, Macron is over there trying to sell Chinese people, French pig pork.
Yeah, well, you'll understand that the Chinese Communist Party are a bit long in the tooth. And they didn't stay in power all these years by being stupid. And they know what's being done to them.
In the noughties, the swine flu epidemic the actual swine flu epidemic amongst pigs has the hallmarks as well, with circumstantial evidence of the outbreak raising questions. It wasn't widely reported, but seems the final conclusion of the Chinese biochemists was the same, that the SARS virus also was probably man-made.
Well, there's a retired Chinese admiral who is outspoken about all of this. I've forgotten his name. But, of course, the Chinese as a whole say nothing. So, you see, part of what they're trying to do there is create panic in the population. If you turn around and say, in actual fact, we think this is a biowarfare attack and it's really dangerous, everybody's going to panic. So they have to, from their point of view, they've got to talk it down. But, of course, they then start thinking, right, what are we going to do to get even? And that's war talk, isn't it?
Yeah, especially it does create ferment within the population if it looks as if the authorities can't cope with the situation. May just be a natural outbreak. Anyway, what's your conclusion from what you've heard, Kevin?
Well, playing biowarfare is dangerous because the viruses, if you put them into spectrometers and things, have fingerprints. And it's not impossible to figure it, you know, with really advanced techniques. But the other thing none of us pay any attention to is we have bio labs in this country at Port and Down, and everything that humans do is subject to errors and mistakes. And bio labs handling really dangerous material are probably not safe. I don't think they're safe.
Zero Hedge were suspended from Twitter for publishing an article saying, is this the man behind the global coronavirus pandemic? And maybe he is, maybe he's not, is a question mark at the end of the sentence. But Twitter still decided that this was a good reason to suspend Zero Hedge. In light of the growing speculation, the article said, most of it within less than official circles, the official theory and the spread of the coronavirus epidemic, someone ate bat soup at a Wuhan seafood and animal market was the beginning of it. What do you make of this, Martin? Zero Hedge actually being suspended for speculating. Now, this guy that they've pointed the finger at is the head of one of these biological labs in Wuhan. And, I mean, they're not saying he's done it, but they're saying, look, here is the bloke that's in charge of the lab. At least talk about the lab and maybe... I mean, it seems to me like that's a decent bit of investigative journalism.
Yep.
It is, and of course, don't forget, if the whole thing is an elaborate psychological warfare operation, you choose to do it in Wuhan because you know that's where the Chinese labs are, and if they've actually got contracts with DARPA. Whitney Webb has done very good research into the links of these labs with the U.S. military industrial complex, and of course, if you've got people on the inside, they can release the virus, which then makes the Chinese government look bad, and then whatever they do is going to be... If it comes out in the end that Western intelligence services and their hench people have done this, how wicked is that?
But it's a fait accompli, isn't it? The thing often happens is, well, it takes months and months, or maybe even years, to discover something, and in the meantime, you get the geopolitical result you wanted.
That's why they do it, Tony.
I'm thinking about things like the Ghouta chemical weapons attack.
Well, indeed, which has been debunked completely by the actual people on the ground who went to Ghouta, and they said, well, there was no evidence of a chemical weapons attack, but you can tell, bet your bottom dollar, that all the people in Parliament, apart from a few brave souls, believe that there was a chemical weapons attack, even though there wasn't. And it's actually the white helmets, which are the Russians have been flagging up, there's going to be another one. They've already made the video.
Yes, I saw
in Idlib.
For Idlib, that was fascinating. I haven't seen the white helmets on the Channel 4 News.
They've been largely discredited.
Was it? Here we go.
Yeah, the white helmets were on Channel 4 yesterday. It was the main story.
Well, there you go. So they're preparing all of this stuff all the time. Now, the fact is, what we know about Western intelligence services is that they do engage in all kinds of very, very nefarious psychological warfare. The bombing of Bologna railway station, the
but
bombing
this isn't
of Piazza
just psychological.
Cantare,
this is not just
years.
Psychology, Martin. This is killing hundreds of people.
Yes, but psychological warfare involves killing people, but it involves killing people in order to create panic, in order to get effects. It's not just brainwashing. They see themselves as very, very sophisticated operators. And that we've now got, with the internet, access to loads and loads of stuff is out there for people to look at. And frankly, they should know this. And Posimato, who was the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book that came out in 2012 accusing NATO intelligence services of orchestrating all the terrorism in Italy in the 60s, 70s and 80s. All of it. Run from shape in Brussels. And he knew that because of the investigations which he led by the Italian police force into NATO's intelligence service.
So the update
killed hundreds of people. Who they are.
Coronavirus is today 638 deaths, four from the Royal Caribbean ship in Bayonne, which is to undergo testing. And this is itself a rather chilling effect of all of this, Kevin, is that people are being told you've got to stay on this ship. And meanwhile, some of the people are actually catching it on the ship.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's looks really bad, the stuff on the ship. But you're slightly skipping the fact that there are at least three cases in the UK, confirmed cases. And I suspect, I mean, there's terrific traffic between China and the UK. And we are going to have, I think, a serious problem. And one thing that puzzles me, though, is SARS was in 2003, and even the disease center in Atlanta wasn't saying definitely it had been traced to bats and camels. It might have been, but, 17 years later, don't you think they could have worked it out?
Okay, apparently.
Why the long delays in the science?
The Brits, the third UK patient who's got this, caught it in Singapore. So people are being asked to self-isolate. The initial advice only covered mainland China. Don't go there, basically, the British government's saying. But that now includes Thailand, Japan, Republic of Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, and Macau. So you can go, but they're saying if you're doing it, you're doing it at your own risk.
Mm. Yeah, well, if you think of the economic effects of this are potentially going to be disastrous, even if it isn't particularly, it doesn't look as deadly as it might be. Quite a lot of people seem to survive, although you can apparently get it twice and stuff like this. But, of course, the Chinese economy, after the crash in 2008, they pumped their economy up, chucked loads of money at it to keep it rolling. And because they did that, the Western powers were protected from their own malfeasance over their own stock markets. But of course, the Chinese, far from being rewarded for their public spiritedness, are now going to have their own economy taken down. It's quite clear what Pompeo and these other people want to do. They want to take down the Chinese economy. Which is absolutely bizarre and stupid if you think about it. If the Chinese
this is competition, isn't it?
It's warfare.
Market forces.
No, it's warfare. And of course, warfare is competition. Of course it is. The question is, you've just got to win it.
Is it Kevin?
No, I think Martin is right. The American idea of competition does move into warfare. They don't misdistinguish between warfare and competition.
They want to dominate the world, we were hearing last week.
Yeah, and the Chinese are a particular, they openly say we've got to get them now, because if they carry on developing the way they are,
this reminds me of the attitude to Cuba in the 1960s.
Well, yes.
And the missile gap. They were saying unless we have a nuclear war now in the 1960s, they're going to overtake us in the number of nukes.
That's how mad these Dr. Strangelove's are.
Yeah, and the US has been.
They also provoked the Japanese into attacking them at Pearl Harbor. They just basically pushed them and pushed them and pushed them. They knew they would probably attack, and they actually knew that the attack was coming in, and they used it as a means to then drag themselves into the war and then dominate the whole region at the end of it. These people are very vicious, and they've got a track record of bad behavior. It's not.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, sticking with the Americans, we've got a very interesting stage, haven't we, in the Democratic nomination process, which is the Iowa and the New Hampshire caucuses, which apparently, maybe you can put me straight, either of you, that's where it's all decided.
No, it's not all decided. They're there.
Well, they often say
they're just the ones who get to vote first in the caucus system, which they have in the US.
And they're picking.
And they're a tiny little state, so they get overwhelming interest in them because they're the first ones.
I think,
to
Martin,
vote.
You know what I'm saying, and that is quite often the person who wins one of these caucuses will go on to get the nomination.
It's important. That's why Iowa is important, because you get momentum.
But we had a rather nasty situation in Iowa, in that there was some sort of mobile app that everyone was using that didn't work. So, what's this all about?
Well, there's a very good article about this, which I've sent you, Tony, which we can probably put up on our show page so that people can read it. The app was provided to the Democratic Party structure in Iowa by companies which have got strong links to Buttigieg, who's the guy who claimed to have won.
Buttigieg.
Buttigieg, or whatever his name is. And basically, what's happening here is what happened last time in 2016.
Okay, let's just stop a second. Let's just pin some facts down here. Billionaire pro-Israel Buttigieg backer Seth Klarman funds a group behind Iowa's disastrous voting app. Behind the app that delayed Iowa's voting results is a dark money operation funded by anti-Bernie Sanders billionaires. Its top donor, Seth Klarman, is a Buttigieg backer who has dumped money into pro-settler Israel lobby groups. And this is by Max Blumenthal, article by Max Blumenthal. Put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. This firm was staffed by Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, campaign veterans, and created by a Democratic dark money, they say, non-profit backed by hedge fund billionaires, including Seth Klarman.
Well, we know from the emails that were leaked to WikiLeaks via Craig Murray, the British ambassador, that the last Democratic primaries were rigged to keep Sanders out.
And it seems like the same sort of thing seems to be
happening.
Same sort
of thing's happening. Now, you've got to remember, in other countries, Ireland, for example, Norway, you can form a political party, and anybody can form a political party, and you can run in elections. In the US, you've basically got a one-party system with two wings to it, and you've got to register to vote in these primaries to choose who the candidates are, but you can only register as a Democrat or a Republican or an Independent, but the system is actually a controlled system. So in other words, controlling the primaries means that you control the final result, because if you can't get the people you want in the primary, then they can't really stand in the national election.
So this guy, Pete Buttigieg, he has announced that he's won.
Yes, he announced that he'd won before the results came in, and the results didn't come in. There's a thing that I've sent you earlier where they've already, somebody was actually tabulating the results, put the results up on social media, and then the results that came through from the system were different from the ones in social media. Guess what? Sanders got loads of votes, but they weren't appearing on the electronic.
Well, let's just have a listen to what this is all about, and have a listen to Bernie Sanders himself speaking the other day as this was all being discussed. What they had was press conferences already, cameras rolling, but nothing to say because the results had been some sort of computer glitch had stopped them.
I have been asked over and over again why I believe that we are the campaign to defeat Donald Trump. And let me tell you why that is the case. At the end of the day, in order to defeat Donald Trump, who will be a very formidable opponent, we are going to need an unprecedented grassroots movement of folks who are prepared to knock on doors and do all of the things that our supporters did in Iowa, and they're doing right here in New Hampshire, and they're doing right now in California, and in Nevada, and South Carolina, and all across this country. Our campaign is, I believe, the campaign that is putting together a multi-generational, multi-racial process in which we are bringing people together around an agenda that is speaking to the working families of this country. We're not out raising huge sums of money for millionaires and billionaires. We have an agenda that is going to take on the millionaires and the billionaires. We have an agenda which is going to deal with income and wealth inequality. We have an agenda which is going to raise wages for the working families of this country. An agenda which says, finally, after 100 years of talk, now is the time to do what every other major country on earth is doing, and that is to guarantee health care to all people as a human right. So I think we have the grassroots movement that wins. We have the agenda that wins. I'm confident that we're going to do really well here in New Hampshire, having won Iowa. We're going to do very well in Nevada. I think we're going to do a lot better than people think in South Carolina. I think we've got a good shot to win California. And bottom line, I believe that we are well positioned to win the Democratic nomination and to defeat the most dangerous president in the modern history of this country. Thank you all very much.
I mean, I think Bernie Sanders is too old, which is ridiculous because I'm nearly as old as him. They need somebody young in America. And it's disturbing to hear who is behind the app. A billionaire with links to Israel doesn't sound good at all. Very suspicious.
It is very suspicious. And I think the problem with Bernie Sanders is probably too old. Tulsi Gabbard is quite young, and she's definitely a rival.
We're talking about the Democratic stuff at the moment.
She's a Democrat. Yeah. And she's running for president, but we don't get to hear about her because she's been shafted in another way. Yeah, Now, the fact is that the US elections are rigged by billionaires and the secret services. All this stuff about the Russians rigging the election is ridiculous. The US secret services rigged the elections, and then they accuse the Russians of trying to rig their elections.
It's interesting. Tulsi Gabbard's interesting, isn't it? An article in the New Jersey, I think it's called, .com. The Democrats are denying a voice to their strongest candidate. What's going on?
Well, she's basically, she's an Iraq war veteran.
Well, should we have a listen to her? It'd be interesting to hear what she's got to say.
Have you got something?
Yes,
on
I have. Yeah.
Put her on then. I mean, she should be doing well, but of course, because she's so radical, they're trying to just shut her up completely. They can't shut Sanders up because he's an old guy and they can't shut him up.
We should never have gone to war with Iraq. We are not at war with Iraq. Then why is this provision still in place? It is in place and it is being abused. It's not like it's sitting in the cobwebs in the corner somewhere and people have just forgotten about it. This 2002 authorization against Iraq to own overthrow Saddam Hussein is being used now. It's being used now. And this is something that I was surprised by as Trump went and took out one of Iran's top military officials. Many members of Congress from both parties saying, okay, what legal authority do you have to do this? Because you certainly didn't come to Congress to get that declaration. And one of the answers from Secretary of State Pompeo and some others in the administration, including the U.S. Attorney General's office, said that they're using that 2002 authorization against Iraq. Doesn't make sense, right? Because he's an Iranian military official. The answer we got was, well, he was physically in Iraq, so we're good. It would be funny if I was joking, but these are freaking seriously high-level officials in our own government who don't seem to be able to comprehend. I'm not an attorney, but I've read that authorization many times just to check and make sure. And it's an authorization against the Iraqi government. Not anyone who happens to be in Iraq who we want to take out.
He wasn't just anyone.
He was not just anyone. You're right. He was a high-level official in the Iranian government.
He designated the terrorist and the embassy was under attack at the time.
He was the entire military organization that he led was designated a terrorist organization by the Trump administration.
By the Obama
administration? No, not by the Obama administration. The decision that Trump made after he withdrew from the Iran nuclear agreement, further escalating the tensions between our two countries, was to designate the IRGC as a terrorist organization, just like ISIS, something that no country has ever done to any other nation's military force before. That's beside the point. My point is, if Trump wants to go to war with Iran and take out their military, he's got to come to Congress to do so and not use a legal authority that has nothing to do with going to war with Iran. So these were the two actions that we took in Congress today, to completely repeal this 2002 Iraq authorization so no one can use this as an excuse to go to war with another country again without coming to Congress. And number two, once again, making sure that Congress is upholding its authority to stop yet another presidential war.
So that's the voice of Tulsi Gabbard. You got what you wanted for, Kevin. You said we should have someone younger. There she is.
She sounds like she knows what she's talking about. Is she a congresswoman?
She's a congresswoman for Hawaii. She's of Hindu origin. She served in Iraq. She's a colonel in the National Guard.
She has a very substantial military record, doesn't
yes,
she?
Yes, she does, yeah. So they can't accuse
and
her.
She's 40 and she's around about 40 years old.
Yeah, but she's very,
younger,
very anti-war. And that's her big thing.
This happens.
I mean, sometimes soldiers are the ones who actually know that this is a load of nonsense, you know.
They've seen it and they don't want to see it again. The best
that's right. The fact is, what they've tried to do with her is just marginalise her.
Yeah.
Because she's coming from the outside. It's very. You see, the caucus system in the US really came to fruition in the 1960s and allowed outsiders to come forward, whether it was Jimmy Carter or Ronald Reagan.
So how have they shut Tulsi out then?
Well, what they've done is they've rigged the system now. I mean, that's what you do, is you open it up and then realize, oh, no, we're not going to open it up.
Hold on. Why are we talking about an obscure part of the American electoral system when Trump beat up Boris Johnson 2 days ago and Mike Pompeo came here, the Secretary of State, to threaten Boris? Now, the Financial Times got the Trump story. It was the lead story last night at midnight. Everybody picked it up. And by 8 o'clock this morning, only the FT were running it. The BBC dropped it.
So what's happened, Kevin?
Downing Street and the Americans put the heat on the BBC and said, oh, no, it wasn't like that. Well, I believe the FT, and I think it was like that, that Trump shouted Boris out and didn't listen to him and screamed at him. And then you've got this creep, Pompeo, coming in saying, we'll make you pay the World War One debt, which is still in place and is about $100 billion, which is a serious threat. And then they're doing other things like saying, we'll stop our link to GCHQ. Well, great stuff. GCHQ is a participant with the Americans in the criminal surveillance of this country. That's in the parliamentary record.
One thing that Tulsi Gabbard this week, Martin, is that she has sued Hillary Clinton for $50 million over Russian asset remarks. 2020 contender alleges that Clinton made defamatory statements in a deliberate attempt to derail her presidential campaign. So she said that Hillary Clinton, who's in the same party, said that Tulsi Gabbard is a Russian asset. Now, what was going on in the Labour Party? It sounds like you've got the same sort of infighting going on in the Democrats in the States.
What goes on all around the world is that the system fights to keep the system going, and anybody who tries to rebel against it has to deal with the fact that they're going uphill against a system which is designed to keep them out. And you could say, well, let's not bother with politics at all, and politics shows. We all just go and form cooperatives, sing songs. I don't know, but you've got to do something, haven't you? And that means you have to engage. Tulsi Gabbard, I would like to see Tulsi Gabbard president of the United States, and I'd like to see Maria Zakharova president of Russia. But I'm not going to get my views. I'm not going to get either of those.
Well, you may do. Who knows, Martin?
I've got a vision in my mind of them shaking hands together and saying, let's sort all this nonsense
out. That's because you didn't cross your fingers behind your back. Yeah. Anyway, let's have a listen now, because one of you mentioned the Russian interference in elections, alleged, and this came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Colin Thompson.
We know the Prime Minister has formed and ducking democratic scrutiny at every opportunity. And his party is no stranger to receiving Russian donations. But his repeated refusal to publish the report into Russian interference in UK democracy is unjustifiable and unacceptable. Can the Prime Minister tell us clearly, without bluff and bluster, when the report into Russian interference will be published, why it has been delayed so long, and when will he reconvene the Intelligence and Security Committee?
Mr. Speaker, the report will of course be published in the year's full when the Intelligence and Security Committee is reconstituted, and I think he's likely to be thoroughly, his conspiratorial frame of mind is likely to be thoroughly disappointed by the results.
Well, I think what's in the report is that the Tory party takes a lot of money from Russian oligarchs. And the Russian oligarchs based here in this country are not pro-Putin at all. The idea that the Russian state controls the Russian oligarchy, they've disciplined them, but they're actually quite hostile.
Well, hang on. This is a fascinating little topic, because after Berezovsky and Khodorkovsky, one by one, the Russian state has been basically taking them out, getting them out of the country. Yeah.
No, what's happened is you've got all these oligarchs, Deripaska and all these others, Abramovich, they are not pro-Putin at all. They're actually Putin's opposition. But, of course, they've given lots of money to the Tory party because they're wealthy people, and the wealthy people do that.
Well, they just buy favours from the politicians. Indeed, but
the idea that that's Russian government influence is wrong, but it's also very embarrassing for the Tory party that they're taking money from these sources.
What do you think is in this report, Kevin?
Here's the oddity. Boris is stalling on the grounds that the Intelligence Committee hasn't been reconstituted. But earlier this week, there was a little note on the Intelligence Agency website saying that it was okay to publish the report.
Ah, what's this?
Can I just come back to Berezovsky, because that's a very important case.
It is, yeah.
Berezovsky was a Putin ally before Putin came to power, and he used to run NTV, he was the richest guy in Russia and all the rest of it.
Well, he started the first independent TV channel,
didn't he?
But anyway, after the end of Yeltsin.
He was a very corrupt oligarch, basically. And
Running the show.
But what happened with him is once Putin came to power, they fell out. Because Putin came to power, and then he started to...
In the early 1990s, young Putin, was going on skiing holidays with Berezovsky in Switzerland.
Yeah. In other words, they were allies, but they fell out. Because Putin basically is from what they call the Soliviki, which is the security side of the Russian state. You've got the oligarchs, and you've got the Soliviki. The Soliviki are basically ex-military, like Putin. And they've got a different kind of view of things. Anyway, so they fell out, and then Berezovsky came to the West and carried out. And he made both of them, or Berezovsky certainly, involved in the apartment bombings in September 1999. But anyway, so he comes to the West, and he's being feted by the West as the democratic opposition to Putin. Anyway, for years and years, he funded the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. He's basically from the West trying to, topple the Russian government. He didn't succeed, and eventually he was getting fed up with it. And I understand that he basically approached the Russian government, and said, well, I'd like to come back to Russia.
Sounds a bit like the Skripal story.
That's another twist to it. But anyway, he was about to go back to Russia, and then he supposedly committed suicide in his Surrey mansion. By hanging himself. His security detail had disappeared for the afternoon to go shopping, and people came back to find that he'd hung himself in his bathroom. Now, the coroner in Surrey refused to sign it off as suicide. Now, you'd have thought that the Western media and government would have immediately jumped on this. Putin's opposition guy has committed suicide. He hasn't really committed suicide. The coroner says he's not accepting it's suicide. He must have been killed by the Russians. In actual fact, what his daughter, Berezovsky's daughter, believes is that he was killed by MI6 because he knew too much about all the evil things they'd been doing in Russia over the years.
It's okay to know too much, but you're just not allowed to blab it around.
Well, that's right. And dead men tell no tales. But interestingly enough, the coroner refused to sign it off. But nevertheless, nothing was said about it, and the British government's position is he did commit suicide, even though the coroner says he didn't. But you don't get that on BBC, do you?
You certainly don't. You get an inside track. Okay, also this week, Turkey deploys extremists to Libya, the local militias say, according to the Associated Press. So Libya is just getting a whole load of extremists via Turkey. So where are bits of these extremists come from?
Well, they were, at one stage during the war in Syria, they were bringing Libyan Islamic Fighting Group people, like Abdul Hakim Belhaj and others, into Syria to fight the Assad government. And now, because they're being driven out of Syria, they're funneling the same people back to Libya. Yeah, there's a sort of Islamic International Brigade, which is run by the Western intelligence services, including the Turkish MIT.
But the Turks don't get on too well with the Brits and the Americans at the moment, do they?
They've all got intelligence services, and they're all involved in dirty business of one kind and another. But you mentioned the young girl that's not going to get her passport.
Shamima Begum.
Yeah, Shamima Begum. Well, that was very interesting, wasn't it? She was arrested in Turkey, and that when she was arrested by the Turkish civilian police, the guy that was recruiting her to go out to fight for ISIS turned out to be working for Canadian intelligence.
No, it wasn't her that was arrested. It was him that was arrested, and all her details were found on his computer.
Yeah.
By the Turks.
Yeah, but you've got splits in the Turkish setup. So the civilian police are trying to do a job of catching people bringing Islamists in. Meanwhile, MIT and the military are basically bringing these people in, and including the Canadian intelligence services. So we were bringing loads of people being brought in from Britain, from everywhere
else. Once Shamima went into Syria itself from southern Turkey, she was handed over to a guy with a British accent, according to Turkish media reports.
The Syrian intelligence services, the Turkish police who carried out the arrest, they were then accused of treason by Erdogan. And they were then sent to prison. So you've got struggles going on in most societies between civilian police who've got a certain job to do and the actual military intelligence side of things, which are basically the criminals.
Before we get off all this, Martin, also we didn't cover it last week. We should have done, really. A CIA chief behind the Soleimani's assassination apparently was killed in a down plane in Afghanistan, according to some. This is Middle East Monitor on the 28th of January. So this hasn't been reported very much, has it? Russian intelligence sources have claimed that Michael Dandrea, head of CIA operations in Iran, who orchestrated, allegedly, the assassination of Iranian General Soleimani, was killed in a US spy plane downed in Ghazni in Afghanistan.
Well, it's, the reason it's not been reported is partly because it's not been confirmed, and of course they just refuse to say whether he's dead or
well,
not.
Well, the Russians apparently have.
The Russian intelligence services said, well, we think he was on that plane. And of course it was a high-flying plane. The Taliban have shot down helicopters before. They've never shot anything at that level. And it may well be that the Iranians
the other thing is the United
are getting their retaliation in
the
second.
United States have said that they're actually, they're only releasing two names of people that were on there, but the Taliban who were on the ground and saw the wreck said that there were something like seven or eight bodies in the wreckage.
Yep. So in other words, what may have happened after the killing of Soleimani, you see, the Iranians will just say it's nothing to do with us, but of course the other side will know very well it was to do with them, and they're sending a message probably to the Americans, you can kill our people, but your children are going to cry too. Bang.
So what do you make of that Soleimani assassination, Kevin?
Well, I think that this, the reporting of the American plane brought down in Afghanistan was bizarre. Maybe it was brought down and maybe it did crash, maybe it didn't. But I think the reports that Martin has just quoted are credible. And I think it is the Iranians saying, sure, you can kill our people, we can kill yours. And the whole thing is sordid. Sorry.
That's right. And, of course, the Iranians will never say, yeah, we did it, because that's not the way they operate.
No, if they have sense, they'll...
Yeah. I mean, it's the Americans who say, hey, we did it, and we're proud of it. They go, we're not saying anything, but he's dead.
No, but Tony, can I just very gently steer you back to Trump beating up Boris Johnson? I mean, the lead story in the Financial Times, huge. And, like I said, I think it's credible. And then Pompeo turns up to threaten. I think we should have a look. Martin, what do you think?
Well, I think we're in an abusive relationship with them, aren't we?
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to... Especially when it comes to trying to thrash out a trade deal.
Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
Now to look at Princess Diana, because that is the subject of, we've got this kind of parallel going on, really, between Harry and Diana, where Harry just cannot sit comfortably within the royal family. Maybe the reasons are different, but let's have a listen to a clip from the documentary about Prince Harry, which was done by Tom Braby from ITV News. And this is what Harry's got to say for himself.
You know, my mum clearly taught me a certain set of values of which I will always try and uphold, despite the role and the job that sometimes that entails, if you know what I mean. But I think I will always protect my family, and now I have a family to protect. So everything that she went through and what happened to her is incredibly raw every single day, and that's not me being paranoid, that's just me not wanting a repeat of the past. And if anybody else knew what I knew, be it a father, be it a husband, be it anyone, you'd probably be doing exactly what I'm doing as well.
So the survey, one of the recent ones, was saying 38% of Brits think that Diana's death was not an accident. In France, they're much more sceptical, I mean, closer to where it happened. 6 out of 10 yellow vests in France believe that Diana, Princess of Wales, was killed in Paris. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to an interview I did a while ago with John Morgan, who wrote this book about, which I think is absolutely the best, most forensic book about this. It's not trying to paper over any cracks. It's looking at the police reports from France and Paris. He was leaked a whole load of documents as well. John Morgan was the author of Princess Diana, The Paris-London Connection.
The sources are mainly the official evidence, like the inquest itself, which ran for 6 months, and 7,000 pages of transcripts, and then also the Paget report, which I think was 832 pages.
That was a British police report, was it?
Yes, that's right, yes. And then also there was a whistleblower who leaked several hundred documents to me that were from within the British police investigation, Paget, and that they came to me in 2010 after I'd published a couple of volumes of the Diana Inquest series. those documents were pretty critical.
And have you been able to verify those?
Oh, yeah, they are things like the post-mortem reports for Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed, which the jury were prevented from seeing. So, you know, the jury were expected to establish the cause of death. That's what their job is, to establish the cause of death. The jury were prevented from seeing the post-mortem reports for Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed.
I mean, I think you've made a very good case, really, for it being an assassination. Who were MI6 people in Paris that weekend, then?
Okay, well, the one who was headed the operation was Sherard Cooper-Coles, or Cooper-Coles, I think as it's pronounced. He was brought into Paris just within 2 weeks of when the crash occurred.
And what evidence have you got that he was actually involved, though? I mean, he could have been just having a holiday there or something.
No, well, it's very complex to establish which people were involved, but there's evidence there that he was brought in at a very late stage and that he was the head of the political department there. So, no, he wasn't on a holiday. No, he was.
Right, you're talking about the British Embassy?
Yes, in the British Embassy, yes.
Okay, what about motives? You know, there must be motives. I mean, I would suggest possibly people talk about landmines, don't they? They talk about possibly Dodi al-Fayed and Mohammed al-Fayed being quite important pro-Palestinian campaigners. What are your thoughts about what the crux of the motive was?
Yeah, well, landmines, I think, plays a very important role. I mean, she was upsetting people in high places. That's basically the issue. Off the landmines, she was upsetting people in high places. She had a very powerful, and people probably forget, but she was a powerful woman. And when you saw the footage of her walking through the minefields in Angola and in Bosnia, these images went right around the world, and I can remember them here in Australia. And she had the power to influence public opinion. The authorities would have known that she wasn't going to stop at landmines. If she'd got rid of all the landmines, then she'd be working on other weapons, you know. So you've got that aspect of it. And then the other aspect is, yeah, Mohammed al-Fayed, the relationship of him taking the boys, the future king, to a holiday at Mohammed al-Fayed's villa in the south of France. You know, like, Mohammed al-Fayed, he was sort of anathema at that time. He had been involved in the Kashmir questions that had helped bring down Tory government in May 1997. So that upset senior royals and no doubt a lot of other people. I mean, it was very controversial at the time. If you look at the media reports of the assessments about Princess Diana going there for a holiday, you know, and then the ensuing relationship with Dodi, and then you could have a Muslim stepfather to the future king.
Have you come across any evidence that she was pregnant, John?
Yeah, there is evidence. Yeah, there is evidence that she could have been pregnant. I don't think pregnant for very long. I think for probably a fairly short period. But, you know, there's things like when a person has a car crash and arrives at the hospital, blood tests are taken. You know, that's just a normal thing. And yet there's no evidence of any blood test that has come forward. So
that's interesting. They may have actually found that she was pregnant. Who knows? I mean, the whole thing does sound a little bit medieval, doesn't it? It's almost like the princes in the tower. What do you think the role of the royal family was? Because I know they had something called the Way Ahead Group, didn't they? Which was looking at how the royal family was going to survive despite Diana.
Yeah, that's right.
What was this Way Ahead Group? Who was on it, and what was its mission?
Yeah, the Way Ahead Group was co-chaired by the Queen and the Lord Chamberlain, and that consisted of senior members of the royal family, and then all of their private secretaries. So they would meet twice a year. One of the things that's very interesting about this is that at the inquest, the private secretaries of the Queen, Fellows, and the private secretary of Prince Philip, both those guys gave a substantial amount of evidence. They were cross-examined instead of the royal family themselves being cross-examined, which is what should have happened, as they were the suspects. But these guys were cross-examined over the Way Ahead Group, and they just consistently said, no, the Way Ahead Group, all it is was a committee set up to sort out the royal timetables, you know, and established that there was no conflicts with royal family engagements. So this counters against about, at that stage, I think it was about 13 years. It was set up in 1992, the Waiheke Group. 13 years of press reports saying that the Waiheke Group was set up to deal with major issues facing the royal family. So that was a huge conflict there. And all the evidence points to the Waiheke Group being a very, very powerful committee that is used to address issues facing the royal family. So if the royal family wasn't involved in this, why would the private secretaries try and cover up the purpose of the Waiheke Group? And, you know, they said, oh, well, Diana wasn't discussed. Well, it's obvious that Diana was a problem for the royal family. Whether or not they're involved in the assassination is beside the point. The fact is that this was set up to deal with major issues facing the royal family, and it's obvious that Diana would have come up as a discussion point in the committee, and yet there was this complete denial, I call it excessive distancing, where they come up with something that totally removes the possibility, because all the Waiheke Group would deal with was royal engagements.
Was there any evidence that the Waiheke Group was discussing things like Diana and Dodi's trip to the south of France with William and Harry?
In July, there was a special meeting of the Waiheke Group. Normally they meet in January and September each year. In that year, 1997, there was a special meeting in July, and that's very unusual. And just ahead of that meeting, 3 days ahead, there was a press article, obviously from a leak from someone in the royal household, saying that Diana was the top of the agenda at the next Waiheke Group meeting on the 23rd of July. So, I mean, these leaks, they don't come out of thin air.
Well, of course, I mean, that was the time that all this would have been being discussed. So, I mean, was the coroner at the inquest, was the coroner asking questions about the cross-examining fellows and other personal private secretaries to the Duke of Edinburgh and the Queen, saying, well, hang on, we've got evidence here, you were talking about Diana at the Waiheke Group?
Yeah, well, the coroner wasn't, but the other, some of the lawyers like Michael Mansfield were. But basically, it was just denial, 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 you know. Oh, no, Diana was never discussed. No. There wasn't much interest in her. They said, oh, the Queen and Philip weren't that much interested in her, you know, at that stage. I mean, she had been turfed out of the royal family in August 1996, but she had become a thorn in their side, and, you know. So you've got press leaks saying that, and then you've got the private secretary saying, no. It's all just nothing.
Well, and John Morgan goes on to talk more about the Waiheke Group, and they did have a special meeting of the Waiheke Group just a few weeks before Princess Diana died in that accident. But anyway, folks, there's quite a lot of people around the world do think she was killed. Is it feasible? What do you think, first of all, Kevin?
50-50. The evidence isn't in.
I think it's quite possible that they would do things.
You should read the book, really. It's called The Princess Diana, the Paris-London Connection, The Death of Princess Diana, yeah.
Well, I think they are quite capable of doing something like that. The question is, did they do it?
The next is a really interesting story, I thought, when you brought it up with me, Kevin, which is Future Forward. The Thai opposition party is cleared over Illuminati claims. Well, a whole court case going through in China is to prove that the opposition party in Thailand, a court in Thailand has acquitted one of the country's largest opposition parties after it was accused of having links to a mythical secret society. Well, they say mythical. Is it mythical?
No, it wasn't mythical at all. Beethoven was a member, Mozart. It was big and very widely spread in what is now Germany. In the 1700s, 1800s, it was a serious group, and it was substantial, and it still is.
So what makes you say it still is? That's a big claim to make.
If you hunt, and so you can pick some of it up on the web, if you hunt through the more obscure orders of Freemasonry, you find that they have a number of sub-organisations, which they even call Illuminati. So they're still here.
Okay, the formula, apparently, the aims of the Illuminati, Martin, are the abolition of monarchy and all truly representative government, the abolition of private property, the abolition of inheritance, the abolition of patriotism, abolition of the family, marriage and morality, and abolition of religion, as well as controlling education.
Well, who's saying that?
No, that's not the Illuminati.
You know, I mean, the Illuminati and Freemasonry exist. And, of course, the propaganda duo, propaganda duo, which ran all of the gladio structures inside Italy during the 70s and 80s, involved in all the terrorism, they were Freemasons. But, of course, that doesn't mean that they're trying to abolish all religion and all the rest of it. That's a load of guff, really.
Okay, so I'll put up some links anyway to the origin of that, which I think is a book called World Revolution, but I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Time to sign off for the US Owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guests, and you'll find this show's podcast.
And
our contact links at thisweek.org.uk. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend with Billy tomorrow morning and Danny on Sunday evening. Our sister show Dialects here at Tuesday at noon. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. And I'll put some extra bits on the podcast.